ultimately for the Internet. I still suggest a group call to work things out and reestablish a united front. I don't want to get any more calls from people on one of the lists asking me what the fuck is going on with the leaders. And if you continue to ignore my public requests for answers, please at least acknowledge that you got this email and have an interest in solving the problem. TJ called for another phone conference, wherein all parties agreed to behave. The countdown to C-Day continued. John and Rick made a little wager on who could get the most TLDs enlisted, a 30-year-old bottle of Glenfiddich scotch. It was no contest. John ended up securing commitments from 100 of the TLDs himself. Rick corralled the other 16. By the end of March, they had done the impossible. Poland had certain legal constraints. Its registry could not by law set aside the projected domain names without being paid, and since there was no time to change the law, Rick pulled out his own credit card again. The results amazed the cabal. They had done it. The botmaster had challenged them to do the impossible, and they had done so. John was more amazed than anyone else. The request was outrageous, and yet everybody said yes. Every one. Some took a little longer than others, but eventually they all signed on. The response improved his estimation of human nature, not to mention his liquor cabinet. Rodney waxed Churchillian, calling it our finest hour. Still, none of them was cocky enough to believe that when April 1st rolled around, the worm would be completely contained. There was the peer-to-peer issue to consider. Even if every last one of the possible domains was tied down to Chris Lee's sinkhole, the bots could theoretically bypass the web lookups altogether and update themselves directly. So the cloud still hovered. And the rest of the world was suddenly, as the clock approached C-Day, waking up to Conficker. Way up. The effort now included hundreds of eager geeks worldwide, laboring in subgroups of the cabal. Knowledge of the effort had spread farther still, with all those government agency staffers Rodney and others had been beseeching for weeks. With so many people engaged and interested, the story started showing up everywhere, well beyond the prescribed borders of the cybersecurity trade blogs. Only as it traveled, the message got distorted. It grew and grew. In mid-March, as the countdown moved towards single digits, alarms began to sound in the wider world. This enormous botnet was programmed to call home and get instructions on April 1st, and nobody knew what was going to happen. A dedicated team of experts had been working around the clock for months to stop it, but there was no guarantee they would succeed. It was as good as the plot of a Hollywood thriller. Was the Internet going to explode? Would e-commerce grind to a halt? The vital computer networks governing the nation's electrical grid, air traffic control, transit systems, telecommunications, were they going to fly off the rails? Would there be vast theft, targeted takedowns, cascading failures? Again, it was John Markoff at the New York Times who started things off, the first of the mainstream reporters to weigh in, just as he had reported first on the Morris worm 2 decades earlier. Markoff had dinner with Rick in San Francisco, and his update on the Conficker threat ran a few days later, on March 19th, under the entirely sensible headline, Computer Experts Unite to Hunt Worm. An extraordinary behind-the-scenes struggle is taking place between computer security groups around the world and the brazen author of a malicious software program called Conficker, his story began. He summarized the global nature of the threat, pointing out that the worm had built a botnet to match any in history, and referred to the struggle as a cat-and-mouse game that the cabal was in danger of losing. He noted the government's apparent lack of knowledge or interest. Typically, it was Rick who furnished the punchiest quote. I walked up to a 3-star general on Wednesday and asked him if he could help me deal with a million-node botnet. I didn't get an answer. An examination of the Conficker program reveals that the zombie computers are programmed to try to contact a control system for instructions on April 1st, Markoff wrote. there has been a range of speculation about the nature of the threat posed by the botnet, from a wake-up call to a devastating attack. Phil Porras told the reporter, "Perhaps the most obvious frightening aspect of Conficker-C is its clear potential to do harm. Perhaps in the best case, Conficker may be used as a sustained and profitable platform for massive Internet fraud and theft. In the worst case, Conficker could be turned into a powerful offensive weapon for performing concerted information warfare attacks that could disrupt not just countries, but the Internet itself." The account was entirely responsible and accurate. But you don't run a story in the New York Times using terms like zombie computers and devastating attack and frightening without stirring things up. Holy shit! Within days, the cabal's problem was no longer getting people to pay attention. Now it was trying to dampen what amounted to end-time hysteria. Cyber-mageddon! At least in certain circles of the press. The truth is that there was something predictable in these amplified alarms, an edge of, what to call it, sarcasm. Sarcasm had crept in, and it was, frankly, annoying, even insulting. The public relishes few things more exorbitantly than a good doomsday prediction. At least the ones more apt to prompt a chuckle, as opposed, say, to something remotely real enough to get folks stocking the backyard bomb shelter. This particular cataclysm seemed safely confined to the netherworld of cyberspace. There was no need to hoard canned goods, store water, load the shotguns, or assume the crash position. This was some sort of a virtual apocalypse, a meltdown out there in the parallel universe of incomprehensible computer systems, and, face it, not everybody was in love with his computer or the Internet anyway. So what if it had the geeks riled up? Remember Y2K? Predictions of worldwide collapse when the clock ticked over from December 31st, 1999 to January 1st, 2000? Chaos 2000, painted in jubilant scrawls on highway overpasses. Despite the fondest hopes of doomsday lovers everywhere, night had passed into day, the cocks had crowed, New Year revelers had awakened, hungover, rubbed the sleep from their eyes, and life had resumed its normal petty pace. Besides, there was a healthy portion of the population who actually remembered the pre-digital age, who recalled that life had hummed along just fine, and, if truth be told, at a normal speed, a more pleasant speed, before anyone had ever heard of an iPhone. Remember the days when, if you had a problem with your phone, all you had to do was call Ma Bell, and a person answered, and a nice man came right out and gave you a new one. For free. Losing all this Internet crap didn't sound like the end of the world to lots of people. So these reports of a pending Cyber-mageddon began coming with a noticeable wink. Call it the Y2K wink. Conficker even made David Letterman's monologue. His comical announcer, Alan Coulter, called it Conflicker, and warned the Late Show audience to brace itself for a pending catastrophe. The thing had remotely turned on the webcam of Dave's computer and captured him nude. And the pictures will be coming soon to the Internet. The worm was becoming a punchline. It had a hint of the, we're getting our comeuppance here, appeal of the old Godzilla movies. Only this wasn't a fire-breathing dragon emerging from the depths to exact revenge on mankind for having the temerity to split the atom. It was Big Brother. It was HAL. It was the long-awaited, long-predicted confrontation with the machine, the incomprehensible monster with a billion arms that we had foolishly entrusted with all of the details of our personal and public lives. Only, it really probably wasn't. Who schedules Armageddon for April Fool's Day anyway? This was a billion-armed digital monster with a sense of humor. On the last night of March, C-Day Eve, CBS TV weighed in on 60 Minutes, the most watched and most respected news program on the tube. The network had good reason to take Conficker seriously. Its own computer network had been invaded by the worm, so CBS TV played it straight. After going to considerable expense and effort to scrub its networks, Murrow's old channel found the worm no laughing matter. But there was still the Y2K wink. Correspondent Leslie Stahl reported soberly, telling millions of viewers, "The Internet is infected." The story worked primarily as a warning against all forms of creepy, crawly, toxic software. Again, the wink. The segment was a terrific advertisement for commercial security firms, particularly Symantec, whose vice president, Steve Trilling, cheerfully explained the botnet thus. Imagine a network of spies that has infiltrated a country, and every day all of the spies are calling in for their instructions on what to do next. Stahl said, "So far, the bad guys who created it haven't triggered Conficker. It's just sitting out there like a sleeper cell." Ever since 9/11, few Americans didn't sit up straight in their living rooms at the talk of sleeper cells. But these malevolent terrorists were lurking right inside their home computer, perhaps right there, on their lap. When Stahl asked what the worm might do, Trilling answered, "That's the interesting thing. The only thing the worm is being asked to do is to ask for further instructions." "The worm could turn menacing in an instant," Stahl explained, and added, "I'm hearing Jaws music." There it was again, the wink. She wrapped up the report with, "Conficker investigators have been talking about an April Fool's attack, but nobody knows if the instructions will be benign, or something that could disrupt the entire Internet." So, there you had it. If you understood the risk and chose to actually think about it, the very thing Paul Vixie had said he consciously avoided doing, and if you followed the potential risks to where they might lead, there was more than a small chance that the word Cybermageddon was entirely justified. Hey, what if this was really it? The Cabal had succeeded big time in one way. They had publicized the hell out of the worm. They had come a long way from their initial press release in early January, which got mentioned in a few cybersecurity blogs. Now it was an unthinkable disaster in the making, New York Times, a threat that could disrupt the entire Internet, 60 Minutes, a deadly threat, London Guardian. This alarm was being amplified and interpreted by countless smaller news outlets throughout the world, but nearly always with the wink. All of this made the Cabal very uneasy. Their reaction was not unlike the sensations they had felt when Rodney toured the Capitol beating the botnet drum. One of the great risks in pushing the global panic button is, of course, making a fool of yourself. They had wanted to be taken seriously, but this hardly qualified. This was like virtual panic. The public was not so much alarmed as amused. What the hell was going on? The problem was the nature of the thing. The threat was all potential. If you told people that there was a dirty bomb in Times Square, they would understand immediately. But to grasp the threat posed by Conficker, you had to understand how the Internet worked, how vital it had become to modern society, and how much damage someone could do with millions of computers all pulling at the same time on the same rope. Rodney had his own little prayer for the moment. "Please, God, let it be an experiment that's gone wildly right." So a million eyes were watching and waiting when the atomic clocks that calculate coordinated universal time ticked off the final seconds of March 2009, edging toward C-Day, the moment when the sea strain would receive its instructions, when the mighty botnet would wake up, and nothing happened. 11. April Fools. X-Men, our day has come. The X-Men Chronicles. History is done with Appomattox moments. Wars no longer end in ways anyone can describe as satisfactory, much less triumphant. In modern warfare, there is no such thing as unqualified victory or unconditional defeat. No more Lee handing over his sword. No more Shigemitsu scratching out his signature on the deck of the USS Missouri, with newsreel cameras capturing the moment of total surrender, with people dancing in Times Square, kissing strangers. Modern wars peter out. Casualties mount. The public gets surly, the treasury coffers bottom out, the ruling party gets dumped, one no longer wins, one claims victory. Often both sides do. And sometimes both are right, in their own way. Another signature feature of modern war, perception is paramount. In that category, Conficker was definitely a bust, a joke. Lampooning the disaster warnings, a website devoted to malware research, MW Blog, invoked the breakthrough strange loop moment from Hofstadter's Gödel, Escher, Bach, when a complex recursive program pops out of the system, blinks, and starts thinking for itself. This is what security experts around the world have feared for a long time. The Conficker worm botnet grew big enough, and 1 minute past midnight on April 1st, it finally gained consciousness. News is rolling in from New Zealand that a photo frame with embedded XP went crazy and started displaying pictures of dirty deeds done with sheep. The cabal took it on the chin. The geeks had cried wolf again. Wired magazine poked fun that morning on its website in a clever blog written by Kevin Paulson. "We'll track this scourge throughout the day, so check back frequently for the latest updates. The War Room will live blog the cyber apocalypse until the Internet has melted into a smoldering pile of solder and Cat5 cable, or Conficker-controlled androids burst down our doors and pry our keyboards from our hands. Obviously, it's biding its time, lulling us into a false sense of security and planning its next move. Keep watching this page." 1220 EDT, reader reports, "I just got a message that said, Windows has encountered a problem and will need to shut down. OMG! 4:30 p.m. EDT, "First, I survived Conficker T-spotted on Cafe Press. Premature and smug. Might as well wear a sign on your chest saying, Conficker, kill me first." You get the picture. And this was the friendly geek press. To the wider world, Conficker was just another doomsday moment that fizzled, and another reason to take the frantic warnings of the tribe with a grain of salt. But the prospect that nothing would happen on April 1st had actually become the prevailing theory of the cabal itself. The insight that Conficker's botmaster had no interest in crashing the Internet had eased concern weeks earlier over the possibility of anything catastrophic. The whole point of the botnet, at least so far as anyone could tell, was to build a stable, functional infrastructure, a platform, something its creators could use whenever they wished, to sling spam, to pilfer data, maybe even to launch a cyber attack. But the cabal would discover that once you let loose an idea as fun as a global cyber meltdown, there is no taking it back. Some of the more sober publications had done their best. The Wall Street Journal had posted its verdict on its economics website. "The truth is that the threat posed by Conficker is almost entirely theoretical, and that only a handful of dedicated professionals will notice anything out of the ordinary when C-Day comes around." The WSJ blog quoted Phil Porras, exactly the right person to ask. "I don't see anything on April 1st that will cause any significant havoc," he said. "The most likely outcome is that the day will pass and no one will have noticed anything." John Markoff of the New York Times had asked if he could hang around Phil's office on April 1st, and Phil told him yes, but added that he would probably be bored, warning, "Nothing's likely to happen." The Today Show had invited Phil to come on C-Day morning, but he had declined. He hung around his Menlo Park office instead, keeping his eye on his digital ranch and on the list, tending to other things. Markoff didn't come. 3 hours after the coordinated universal time clock ticked into April, T.J. Campana Riley posted, "So we are 3 hours into the event, and I wanted to have a status check. We saw a dip in our sinkhole telemetry this evening at MS, Microsoft, but there are a number of factors at play that could have caused that. The Internet still works. Smiley face emoticon. In fact, something had happened. The worm did exactly what it was programmed to do. The requests for instruction came knocking by the millions from all of the bots scattered all over the world to each of the 500 domains generated for that day, and all of them appeared to have been shunted toward the sinkhole at Georgia Tech, just as John Crane and Rick Wesson and the others had arranged. Was this victory? They wouldn't know for certain for at least a few days if they had blocked every potential command location, and, of course, even if they had, they would have to be perfect again tomorrow, and the next day, and the next, and every day thereafter. But that was unlikely. April 1st was just the first day it would be possible for the botmaster to issue a command. The Cabal had mounted a historic, truly heroic effort to prevent such commands, but only time would tell whether the botnet was fully contained. And with all the publicity they had generated, with everybody in the world watching, wouldn't C-Day be the least likely day for the bad guys to make their move? Given the superb gamesmanship they had demonstrated so far, wouldn't it make more sense for them to let all the hype just go, pfft, send the X-Men a giant raspberry? Rodney Jaffe felt it. He grew increasingly incensed throughout the day with the silly press coverage. He had begun very early in his Phoenix office, chairing by video hookup a 3-hour ICANN security meeting, all the while scanning his email, where members of the Cabal were posting links to the mounting hilarity. Rodney flew to San Francisco later that day to give a talk, and spent the cocktail hour portion of the event railing against idiot journalists. At his suburban New Jersey home office, Andre Domino experienced the day as another coup for the botmaster, who had made them all look foolish. Andre had given an interview the day before to NBC reporters for a segment to air on the Today Show, dressed in a green T-shirt with a mic hanging from the collar, cautioning the reporter, who didn't have a clue what he was talking about, that the botnet might not actually do anything big the next morning, that it might just generate all these new domain names and begin looking for instructions. But then he could see the glaze descend. What could he do about the journalists' love of doomsday predictions and their utter lack of technical proficiency, not to mention their lack of subtlety? His cautionary words slipped off into the ether, sandwiched between the trumpets of impending doom. Still, Andre had kept his eye on his monitors through most of the day, just in case. Very early in the morning in his Alexandria office, Big Dre Ludwig was not letting this get him down. He had been up all night, and was feeling self-congratulatory and a little tipsy. He wrote to the list, "My thoughts are as follows. 1. This has been an amazing effort from the very start on both a technical and logistical level. 2. We made huge political steps, and did what even governments could not effectively do. 3. Regardless of if we completely remove Conficker from the face of the globe, we still walk away with a huge win. 4. This is hopefully just an example of what we can all do when we work together. Collaboration versus competition, plain and simple. This is the first time that this has happened in the registry world. That alone is worth noting, in my view. Us security nerds have been banding together for years now to tackle threats. This has never happened before in the registry, TLD, world. The closest thing we had was little islands, one or two, of registry operators who would actually take action. Even that has been a hell of a battle for some of us to even get done these last few years. This is, in my own view, the fruition of years of work for me, so if you can't tell, I'm more than a bit giddy. I blame the scotch and time of mourning as well." Dre spent most of the day watching the list and various other chat channels, not really expecting to see anything happen, but aware of what might. The worst part of it for him still was not knowing what the botmaster had in mind. No one knew. Why had the worm been created, anyway? Paul Vixey treated it like any other workday. He was in his San Francisco office early, confident that the worm was well confined, at least for the time being. At the very least, they had made the bot master think. Vixey's thoughts turned now to remediation. Time for the industry to wake up and begin fighting viruses directly, targeting infected machines with software designed to search and destroy malware. Clean up whole networks. Maybe Conficker had been the scare everyone needed. He was hopeful, though hopefulness was not his usual state. Rick Wesson was also in his Mission District office, feeling pretty good about things and giving lots of interviews. It was hard to believe all the press attention. He was tired. He had few illusions about their victory, posting to the list, "Nothing happened because our opponent is smart. They waited 2 months before they got the B2C update past me. We weren't even lucky. If the Conficker authors had wanted it, they could have it tomorrow. Everyone deserves pats on the back, but the game isn't over. It just started." John Crane was at home in Long Beach. He, too, watched the list throughout the day, but he assumed this would be the least likely day for the botmaster to make a move. No matter how dismissive the rest of the world might be, the cabal knew the threat was real and would not go away. The botnet was still out there, biding its time. Still, as the days progressed and Conficker did nothing, they wondered. Had their effort with the TLDs entirely succeeded? 1 week after C-Day, that question was answered. The botnet successfully received instructions, apparently via a peer-to-peer connection from a computer in South Korea, and for the first time since it was first spotted in November, the worm did something. Something really stupid. It rented itself out for 2 weeks to a notorious spammer called Wallodak. This enormous botnet, this potential internet destroyer, leased itself out briefly to distribute one of the most pedestrian, well-known species of malware in the taxonomy. And the reaction was, "This is it?" It was like a bad joke. It was like that classic scene in Spinal Tap when, after a breathless build-up of the band's new Stonehenge theme, a replica of the ancient monument is dramatically lowered on stage, but the prop is only knee-high. Or like the moment in an old circus clown act when the villain at last corners the hero, aims a huge pistol, pulls the trigger, and out pops a little flag displaying the word bang. Conficker spread Wallodak for a few weeks and then stopped. What did it mean? For one thing, it demonstrated that the botnet was fully functional, fully capable of receiving instructions. The cabal had apparently shut down access via a website, and this was an amazing accomplishment. But the botmaster performed a simple end run with his new peer-to-peer capability, just as Hassan had suspected when he first dissected the thing. It was taken by most in the cabal as a message from their opponents. It said, "You know what? We know what we're doing. We can use this thing whenever we want." It meant, ultimately, that the enormous effort expended to tie up all those domain names through 116 separate TLD operators, every country code in the world, had failed. It meant the worm won. Or did it? It has now been more than 2 years since C-Day, or Cyb Armageddon, and except for its little stunt with Wallodak, the botnet has done nothing. At least, nothing obvious. And remember the two signatures of modern war. One, you never win, exactly, you claim victory. Two, perception is paramount. So what exactly had happened? The botnet was still out there. Millions of bots automatically churning out domain names by the thousands every day, week after week, month after month, year after year. The sinkhole monitors established by the cabal still chart the activity day by day, hour by hour, minute by minute. The Conficker botnet, this enormous concentration of computer power, had been assembled and was still in the hands of its mysterious creators. Those machines were pwned or owned, and they could be turned to any task the botmaster defined. They could be leased for plunder or marshaled for attack. The cabal had pulled off an impressive feat, dissecting the worm, coordinating an unprecedented global response, and setting up a dynamic, smoothly functioning system to monitor the botnet's data traffic and to sinkhole it. All of that work, the many thousands of hours, the considerable brain power and experience, had been volunteer. There was no budget for it, beyond Rick Wesson's credit cards. And what had it earned them, beyond a sense of satisfaction and the admiration of their small group of peers? In the larger world, it had mostly earned ridicule. They were the guys who had supposedly claimed the sky was going to fall on April 1st, 2009. Of course, they hadn't, but that fact required more explanation than the nightly news was equipped to give. The government had been made somewhat more aware, and, curiously, would even declare victory. A Department of Homeland Security, DHS, Lessons Learned report, issued early in 2011, summed up the effort thus. In an unprecedented act of coordination and collaboration, the cybersecurity community, including Microsoft, ICANN, domain registry operators, antivirus vendors, and academic researchers, organized to block the infected computers from reaching the domains, an informal group that was eventually dubbed the Configure Working Group. They sought to register and otherwise block domains before the Configure author, preventing the author from updating the botnet. Despite a few errors, the effort was very successful. The key word there would be very, as opposed to completely. As Rick had pointed out again and again, almost doesn't cut it. All it takes is one successful link, like the peer-to-peer connection that prompted the Wallodak stunt, and game over. The upbeat DHS report was some kind of high-water mark for government gall, a tough record to beat. After sitting back and watching the cabal do all the work and nearly succeed, Uncle Sam finally found a role for himself. Proclaim victory and then stick a flag in it. It is a curious finding, given that Rodney, who has since become the official head of the cabal, the very same Configure Working Group celebrated in the report, has this to say about what happened. At the end of the day, it's a failure. It's a success as a model and an organization, but we actually don't have control over Configure. We didn't achieve the objective. This DHS report, it should be noted, was also the high-water mark for government involvement in the actual battle. On page 33 of the report itself, one unnamed member of the cabal summed up the Fed's contribution during the actual conflict: zero involvement, zero activity, zero knowledge. Nevertheless, the new administration seemed to get it. Behind a lectern in the East Room of the White House on May 30, 2009, President Barack Obama, who was just moving into the White House when the effort peaked, gave a speech about cybersecurity. "We meet today at a transformational moment, a moment in history when our interconnected world presents us, at once, with great promise, but also great peril." He called the nation's digital infrastructure the backbone that underpins a prosperous economy and a strong military and an open and efficient government. "Cyberspace is real," he said, "and so are the risks that come with it." He cited Configure in particular to illustrate the Fed's anemic capability to defend the Internet. "It's clear that we're not as prepared as we should be, as a government or as a country. Just as we failed in the past to invest in our physical infrastructure, our roads, our bridges and rails, we failed to invest in the security of our digital infrastructure. Indeed, when it comes to cybersecurity, federal agencies have overlapping missions and don't coordinate and communicate nearly as well as they should, with each other or with the private sector. We saw this in the disorganized response to Configure, the Internet worm that in recent months has infected millions of computers around the world. This status quo is no longer acceptable, not when there's so much at stake. We can and we must do better." Most members of the cabal say that the government has gotten better. Some of its members have gone to work for government agencies. U.S. CERT's Michel Kwan, whose performance the cabal found singularly unimpressive, resigned just a few months after the president's remarks. Rodney suspects that the desperate repackaging of his Configure PowerPoint by the agency played a role. In Pittsburgh, there is now the National Cyber Forensics Training Alliance, a privately funded effort affiliated with Carnegie Mellon University and modeled consciously after the Cabal, where federal agents work alongside industry researchers. This alliance has begun to make real progress, training the kind of experts needed to deal with the growing malware threat. There are guys from Target and from eBay and from E-Trade and from other banks who have full-time employees that are assigned there, says Rodney. And when they're able to establish a case, they hand it across the desk to an agent who can now go and get an official case going. It's highly effective. The best bang for the buck in the entire federal government from a cybersecurity point of view. In June 2011, the Pentagon announced that it was putting the finishing touches on a new strategy for dealing with cyber attacks. It will define any attack on important computer networks that leads to civilian casualties to be an act of aggression against the United States. This means that if it can be determined where the attack originated, the nation might respond in a variety of ways, including militarily. It was, however, more a statement of mounting concern than a blueprint for national defense. The policy says nothing about how the United States might respond to a cyber attack from a terrorist group or other non-state actor, wrote New York Times reporters David E. Sanger and Elizabeth Buemiller. Nor does it establish a threshold of what level of cyber attack merits a military response. Despite the vagueness of the pronouncement, it became clear in July 2010 that malware was a serious weapon in the arsenals of great powers. Alarmed by a secret Iranian program to develop nuclear weapons and the inability of international non-proliferation agreements to stop it, nations opposed to the effort, probably the United States or Israel, perhaps both, infected the computer networks in Iran's uranium enrichment plants with a worm dubbed Stuxnet. The worm employed the same buffer overflow exploit at port 445 used by Configure, penetrating Windows operating systems, and was tailored specifically to sabotage the centrifuges used to spin uranium at high speed in order to separate out weapons-grade isotopes. Penetrating a specific variety of software sold by the German engineering giant Siemens AG, the worm caused the centrifuges to spin wildly out of control, destroying the uranium processing facilities and setting back the Iranian effort for years. Even though Stuxnet infected a great many computers outside Iran, its careful design meant that it executed harmful instructions only on the Siemens AG software at the uranium processing plants. It was the first of what are likely to be many carefully sculptured cyber attacks, and clearly learned from the successful implementation of Configure. These kinds of tailored, targeted attacks were considered the trend in early 2011, as I finished writing this book. Criminal attacks in recent weeks had successfully hit the International Monetary Fund, Google, Lockheed Martin, Sony, and Citibank, among others. The difference between these and cyber threats in the past, including Configure, is that they do not spread indiscriminately on the Internet and do not seek to assemble botnets, even though they may use existing botnets as a platform. They are the difference between a smart bomb and a conventional one. They zero in on specific targets and have narrowly defined goals. They illustrate once more the growing sophistication of criminals, spies, and military organizations who remain every bit or more than a match for those who, like the Cabal, seek to preserve the Internet as a free zone for exchanging information and for commerce. This is one of the defining battles of our age, one that takes place, for the most part, out of the public eye. Meanwhile, the Configure botnet itself waits. Most of those in the Cabal now doubt that it will ever be used. The theory here is that the Cabal's coordinated effort, while ultimately unable to kill the botnet, made it too hot to handle. Any move the botmaster makes might help identify him, or them, pinpoint him, bring the law down on him. This is a point of view that supports the claim of victory, albeit victory of a limited sort. Somebody got pissed that we shone a light down their hallway or in their bedroom or whatever, says Dre Ludwig. I mean, realistically, that's what it looks like. Too much attention, too dangerous to play with anymore. And it demonstrated how to mount an effort, concerted effort, to mitigate it. If that thing ever fired up again, we'd get the old band back together. It's been done once. Others, like Andre Domino of Shadow Server, are more inclined to believe that Conficker's controllers are simply biding their time. They are watching us watch them, he says. I'm thinking that it's really either that somebody let this thing get bigger, or it's advanced bigger and farther than they ever dreamed possible. A lot of people think that. But in looking at the sophistication of this thing and looking at the evolution of this thing, I think they knew exactly what they were doing. I think they were trying something, and I think that they're too smart to do what everybody figured they were going to do. You have to remember, the world was watching this thing on April 1st, waiting for the world to end on April 1st. The last thing you'd want to do if you're the bad guy is make something happen then. You're going to wait until, say, May 28th of 2010, or pick any other date to do something. You're going to do something when you're least suspected. These guys are sophisticated. They have good code. And just even seeing the evolution from Conficker A to B to C, these guys know exactly what they're doing. Rodney agrees, and more so. Just because no one has seen Conficker make a move, he says, doesn't mean that it has not. People are saying that Conficker is not really used for anything because it's not, it's just too visible. What's your point that it's too visible? How does a weapons platform become too visible? Do you mean that it's so visible that we know how to stop it? It's really hard to get rid of on infected machines, but Conficker has the holy grail of malware, which is something called stability. There are 6 million machines, and tomorrow there will be 6 million machines, give or take. You can count on this botnet. What a botmaster wants always is to know that his machines are going to be up, that someone isn't going to take them down. This thing has proven that it is rock solid, and that the good guys, the antivirus guys and the Microsoft guys, can't do shit. It is the holy grail of a botnet. So what we have in place is a weapons platform that's capable, and it's going to stay capable. Rodney has a theory. Every day, on average, the botnet loses about 500,000 machines and gains another 500,000. The Cabal's researchers track this. Some machines disappear because they are turned off, wear out, or are replaced, and some because they are disinfected. The Cabal has distributed a free, easy-to-use tool to tell if a computer is infected. Others are added because the worm continues to spread via its peer-to-peer capability. But what if some of those machines that disappear vanish because the botmaster is selling off pieces of the botnet every day to criminal spammers? It's plausible, because the botnet is valuable in any number of ways. It can be used to generate a great deal of computing power, or just as a known store of vulnerable machines to exploit. All of the machines on Conficker's lists have stopped receiving security updates. So when people say Conficker's doing nothing, I don't believe that, Rodney says. We think it's doing nothing because we don't observe anything, but we don't know. And a perfect way for this group to actually be monetizing it in a way that just, like, generates revenue every day and would never be noticed is by sending off targeted pieces to criminals of some kind, whether they are nation-state or just criminals selling off these small pieces, they would just never be noticed. And I believe that's what's happening. So while the Cabal may have pointed the way toward a cooperative defense against Internet threats and may have smartened up the government a little, the worm itself survives. Both sides of the Conficker battle took away valuable lessons. Paul Vixie has plenty of new material for his Internet rant, that speech he gives in his affectless monotone about the Internet as an example of historical folly. His hope 2 years ago, the day Cyber-Mageddon didn't happen, was that after everyone got over the laugh, the Conficker scare might spur efforts toward remediation, a concerted effort to rid machines of the worm. That hope has been disappointed, and he is back to predicting doom. He is also fed up with Microsoft. In a note to the list later in 2009, Vixey fingered what he believes is the heart of the problem. This whole thing is Microsoft's fault. Really. One company brought us Conficker, stock symbol MSFT. The pink elephant in this living room is Microsoft did this to us. I am not referring to Microsoft's continuing monopoly by which they forced all kinds of end users and resellers to include Windows on the 10 million computers now infected by Conficker. That's evil, and if I ever meet a space alien, I will be ashamed for all of humanity at the way we herd our sheeple into pens and suck their blood in this way. Paul pointed out that Microsoft had issued a patch years earlier dealing with exactly the same kind of vulnerability as the one at port 445, but that the company's security software engineers had failed to check to see if the flaw existed elsewhere. What this means, gentlemen, is that some employee of Microsoft patched it in one place without patching it in the other place, even though they were both in the same source file. This means the employee who did the patch, and the reviewers, and the managers, and the QA, quality assurance teams, for MS-06-040, all had a chance to do a thorough review of the source module for any similar code sequence or vulnerability, and they flubbed it. He concluded, "Yo, TJ, nothing personal, man." TJ has been busy. In the last 2 years, he has helped put together a cooperative Microsoft/law enforcement initiative that has taken down, with the help of the U.S. Marshal Service, Wolodak and Rustock, two infamous spamming operations targeting the servers that hosted the criminal enterprise. As a result, he says the company has seen at least a temporary decline in the amount of spam on the Internet. The Conficker botmaster is still out there. In June of 2011, authorities in Ukraine, in cooperation with the FBI, arrested 16 hackers in Kiev who had reportedly used the Conficker botnet to drain $72 million from international banking accounts. The investigation was run out of the Seattle FBI office, the one which has worked closely with TJ, and was assisted by the National Cyber Forensics Training Alliance. Servers in several countries were raided in a coordinated international police action. Those rounded up were all young men between the ages of 26 and 33, who police said had splendid technical educations. It remained doubtful, however, that among this group was the Conficker botmaster, the designer. More likely, these hackers were customers of the botnet's creator, using its stable platform to launch their targeted thievery in exactly the way Harvard's Schechter and Smith predicted in their 2003 Access for Sale paper. Agents were still questioning the suspects as this book was going to press. There were hopes that this group might lead authorities to the botmaster, the true architect or architects of the worm. Rodney is optimistic, even confident on some days, that he or they will be caught. More than a year after the anticlimactic April 1st Wolodak stunt, Rodney, John Crane, Phil Porras, and Andre Domino met with representatives from the White House in Rodney's Neustar office. It was the first time Phil had ever met Rodney personally. Paul Vixey added his gloomy perspective by phone hookup. Andre had prepared lists of Conficker infections on .gov and .mil networks. The scope of the worm's inroads clearly startled the Obama team. Rodney was particularly alarmed that here, more than a year after he had sounded the alarm on Capitol Hill, the Commerce Department, the government's chief computer network guardian, was still not tracking the infection closely itself. At a follow-up meeting several months later, Andre says CERT acquitted itself much better, and the infection rates on .gov and .mil had gone down significantly. So who is the botmaster? Who are the bad guys behind the worm? Ramses Martinez is in charge of security for VeriSign, the Dulles, Virginia company that operates two of the root servers for the Internet. He was a member of the Cabal. One of the things he does, patrolling the perimeter at VeriSign looking for threats, is occasionally dip into the obscure digital forums where cybercriminals converse, where those who write sophisticated malware boast and threaten and compare notes. After all, theirs is a rarefied community, and those engaged in this game have certainly encountered the glaze themselves often enough. The chat rooms are a community of the like-minded, a place where they can show off their chops among those who appreciate their skills, where they can compare notes, learn. White hats like Ramsey's sometimes venture in to collect intelligence, or just out of curiosity, or for fun. Often they pretend to be malware creators themselves, but not always. Sometimes they enter as themselves and indulge in a little cyber trash talk. "In the past, you were just sort of making sure they didn't steal your database of credit cards," he says. "Now we go in to engage them. You talk to them and you exchange information. You have a guy in Russia selling malware working with a guy in Mexico doing phishing attacks that's talking to a kid in Brazil who's doing credit card fraud, and they're introducing each other to some guy in China doing something else." Martinez said he recently eavesdropped on a dialogue between a security researcher and a man he suspects was at least partly responsible for Conficker. He won't say how he drew that connection. He says only that he had good reasons for believing it to be true. The suspect in the conversation was Russian. The standard image of a malevolent hacker is the Hollywood one, a brilliant 20-something with long hair and a bad attitude and in need of a bath. This is not how Martinez sees him. "I see him as a really well-educated, smart businessman," he says. "He may be 50 years old. These guys are not chumps. They're not just out to make a buck." Ramsey's joined the conversation with this fellow. He made no effort to disguise himself, and when the Russian realized whom he was talking to, he quickly retreated from the conversation. He wrote apologetically, "You're the good guys, we're the bad guys. Bacillus can't live with antibodies." And oh, one last thing. Somebody still owes Rick Wesson $30,000. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Worm, The First Digital World War by Mark Bowden. Copyright 2011 by Mark Bowden. Performed by Christopher Lane. Directed by Jim Bond. Engineered by Laura Stahl. Performance copyright 2011 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliancedaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.